the life of God in the soul of man continued, the excellency of divine love. Let us descend, if you please, into a nearer and more particular view of religion in those several branches of it which were named before. Let us consider that love and affection wherewith holy souls are united to God, that we may see what excellency and felicity is involved in it. Love is that powerful and prevalent passion by which all the faculties and inclinations of the soul are determined, and on which both its perfections and happiness depend. The worth and excellency of a soul is to be measured by the object of its love. He who loveth mean and sordid things thereby doth become base and vile, but a noble and well-placed affection doth advance and improve the spirit unto a conformity with the perfections which it loves. The images of these do frequently present themselves unto the mind, and by a secret force and energy insinuate into the very constitution of the soul, and mold and fashion it into their own likeness. Hence we may see how easily lovers and friends do slide into the imitation of those persons whom they affect, and how, even before they are aware, they begin to resemble them, not only in the more considerable instances of their deportment, but also in their voice and gestures, and that which we call their mind and air. And certainly we should as well transcribe the virtues and inward beauties of the soul, if they were the objects and motives of our love. But now, as all the creatures we converse with have their mixture and alloy, we are always in hazard to be sullied and corrupted by placing our affections on them. Passion doth easily blind our eyes, so that we first approve and then imitate the things that are blamable in them. The true way to improve and ennoble our souls is by fixing our love on the divine perfections, that we may have them always before us and derive an impression of them on ourselves, and, beholding with open face, as in a glass, the glory of the Lord, we may be changed into the same image from glory to glory. He who, with a generous and holy ambition, hath raised his eyes toward the uncreated beauty and goodness, and fixed his affections there, is quite of another spirit, of a more excellent and heroic temper than the rest of the world, and cannot but infinitely disdain all mean and unworthy things, will not entertain any low or base thoughts which might disparage his high and noble pretensions. Love is the greatest and most excellent thing we are to be masters of, and therefore it is of folly and baseness to bestow it unworthily. It is, indeed, the only thing we can call our own. Other things may be taken from us by violence, but none can ravish our love. If anything else be counted ours, by giving our love, we give all, so far as we make over our hearts and wills, by which we possess our other enjoyments. It is not possible to refuse him anything to whom, by love, we have given ourselves. Nay, since it is the privilege of gifts to receive their value from the mind of the giver, and not to be measured by the event, but by the desire, he who loveth may, in some sense, be said not only to bestow all that he hath, but all things else, which will make the beloved person happy, since he doth heartily wish them, and would really give them, if they were in his power, in which sense it is that one makes bold to say, the divine love doth, in a manner, give God unto himself the complacency it takes in the happiness and the perfections of his nature. But though this may seem too strained an expression, certainly love is the worthiest present we can offer unto God, and it is extremely debased when we bestow it in any other way. When this affection is misplaced, it doth often vent itself in such expressions as point at its genuine and proper object, and insinuate where it ought to be placed. The flattering and blasphemous terms of adoration, wherein men do sometimes express their passions, are the language of that affection which was made and designed for God. As he who is accustomed to speak to some great person doth perhaps, unawares, accost another with those titles he was wont to give to him, but certainly that passion which accounteth its object a deity ought to be bestowed on him who really is so. Those unlimited submissions which would debase the soul if directed to any other way will exalt and ennoble it when placed here. Those chains and cords of love are infinitely more glorious than liberty itself. This slavery is more noble than all the empires in the world. The advantages of divine love. Again, as divine love doth advance and elevate the soul, so it is that alone which can make it happy. The highest and most ravishing pleasures, the most solid and substantial delights that human nature is capable of, are those which arise from the endearments of a well-placed and successful affection. That which embitters love, and makes it ordinarily a very troublesome and hurtful passion, is the placing it on those who have not worth enough to deserve it, or affection and gratitude to requite it, or whose absence may deprive us of the pleasure of their converse, or their miseries occasion our trouble. To all these evils are they exposed, whose chief and supreme affection is placed on creatures like themselves. But the love of God delivers us from them all. The worth of the object. First, I say, love must needs be miserable, and full of trouble and disquietude, when there is not worth and excellency enough in the object to answer the vastness of its capacity. So eager and violent a passion cannot but fret and torment the spirit, when it finds not wherewith to satisfy its cravings. And, indeed, so large and unbounded is its nature, that it must be extremely pinched and straitened when confined to any creature. Nothing below an infinite good can afford it room to stretch itself and exert its vigor and activity. What is a little skin-deep beauty, or some small degrees of goodness, to match or satisfy a passion which was made for God, designed to embrace an infinite God? No wonder lovers do so hardly suffer any rival, and do not desire that others should approve their passion by imitating it. They know the scantiness and narrowness of the good which they love, that it cannot suffice two, being in effect too little for one. Hence love, which is as strong as death, occasioneth jealousy, which is cruel as the grave. The coals whereof are coals of fire, which hath a most violent flame. But divine love hath no mixture of this gall. When once the soul is fixed on that supreme and all-sufficient good, it finds so much perfection and goodness as doth not only answer and satisfy its affection, but master and overpower it too. It finds all its love to be too faint and languid for such a noble object, and is only sorry that it can command no more. It wisheth for the flames of a seraph, and longs for the time when it shall be wholly melted and dissolved into love. And because it can do so little itself, it desires the assistance of the whole creation, that angels and men would conquer with it in the admiration and love of those infinite perfections. The certainty to be beloved again. Again, love is accompanied with trouble. When it misseth a suitable return of affection, love is the most valuable thing we can bestow, and by giving it, we do, in effect, give all that we have, and therefore it must needs be afflicting to find so great a gift despised, that the present which one hath made of his whole heart cannot prevail to obtain any return. Perfect love is a kind of self-dereliction, a wandering out of ourselves. It is a kind of voluntary death, wherein the lover dies to himself, and all his own interests, not thinking of them, nor caring for them any more, and minding nothing but how he may please and gratify the party whom he loves. Thus, he is quite undone, unless he meets with a reciprocal affection. He neglects himself, and the other hath no regard to him. But if he be the beloved, he is revived, as it were, and liveth in the soul and care of the person whom he loves. And now he begins to mind his own concernments, not so much because they are his, as because the beloved is pleased to own an interest in them. He becomes dear unto himself, because he is so unto the other. But why should I enlarge on so known a matter? Nothing can be more clear than that the happiness of love depends on the return it meets with, and herein the divine lover hath unspeakably the advantage. Having placed his affection on him whose nature is love, whose goodness is as infinite as his being, whose mercy prevented us when we were his enemies, therefore cannot but choose to embrace us when we become his friends. It is utterly impossible that God should deny his love to a soul wholly devoted to him, and which desires nothing so much as to serve and please him. He cannot disdain his own image, nor the heart in which it is engraven. Love is all the tribute which we can pay him, and it is the sacrifice which he will not despise. The presence of the beloved person. Another thing which disturbs the pleasure of love, and renders it a miserable and unquiet passion, is absence and separation from those we love. It is not without a sensible affliction that friends do part, though for some little time. It is sad to be deprived of that society which is so delightful. Our life becomes tedious, being spent in an impatient expectation of the happy hour wherein we may meet again. But if death have made the separation, as some time or other it must, this occasions a grief scarce to be paralleled by all the misfortunes of human life, and wherein we may pay dear enough for the comforts of our friendship. But oh, how happy are those who have placed their love on him, who can never be absent from them. They need but open their eyes, and they shall everywhere behold the traces of his presence and glory, and converse with him whom their soul loveth. And this makes the darkest prison or wildest desert not only supportable, but delightful to them. The divine love makes us partake of an infinite happiness. In fine, a lover is miserable, if the person whom he loveth be so. They who have made an exchange of hearts by love get thereby an interest in one another's happiness and misery, and this makes love a troublesome passion when placed on earth. The most fortunate person hath grief enough to mar the tranquility of his friend, and it is hard to hold it out when we are attacked on all hands and suffer not only in our own person, but in another's. But if God were the object of our love, we should share it in infinite happiness without any mixture or possibility of diminution. We should rejoice to behold the glory of God, and receive comfort and pleasure from all the praises wherewith men and angels do extol him. It should delight us beyond all expression to consider that the beloved of our souls is infinitely happy in himself, and that all his enemies cannot shake or unsettle his throne, that our God is in the heavens, and doth whatsoever pleaseth. Behold on what sure foundation his happiness is built, whose soul is possessed with the divine love, whose will is transformed into the will of God, and whose greatest desire is that his Maker should be pleased. Oh, the peace, the rest, the satisfaction that attendeth such a temper of mind! He that loveth God finds sweetness in every dispensation. What an infinite pleasure must it needs be, thus, as it were, to lose ourselves in him, and being swallowed up in the overcoming sense of his goodness, to offer ourselves a living sacrifice, always ascending unto him in flames of love. Never doth a soul know what solid joy and substantial pleasure is, till once, being weary of itself, it renounce all propriety, giving itself up unto the author of its being, and feeling itself becoming a hallowed and devoted thing, and can say, from an inward sense and feeling, my beloved is mine, I account all his interests my own, and I am his. I am content to be anything for him, and care not for myself, but that I may serve him. A person molded into this temper would find pleasure in all the dispensations of providence. Temporal enjoyments would have another relish when we should taste the divine goodness in them and consider them as tokens of love sent by his dearest Lord and Maker. And chastisements, though they be not joyous but grievous, would hereby lose their sting. The rod as well as the staff would comfort him. He would snatch a kiss from the hand that was smiting him, and gather sweetness from that severity. Nay, he would rejoice that though God did not the will of such a worthless and foolish creature as himself, yet he did his own will, and accomplished his own designs, which are infinitely more holy and wise. The duties of religion are delightful to him. The exercises of religion, which to others are insipid and tedious, do yield the highest pleasures and delight to souls possessed with the divine love. They rejoice when they are called to go up to the house of the Lord, that they may see his power and his glory, as they have formerly seen it in the sanctuary. They never think themselves so happy as when, having retired from the world, and gotten free from the noise and hurry of affairs, and silenced all their clamorous passions, those troublesome guests within, they have placed themselves in the presence of God, and entertain fellowship and communion with him. They delight to adore his perfections, and recount his favors, and to protest their affections to him, and tell him 1,000 times that they love him, to lay out their troubles and wants before him, and disburden their hearts in his bosom. Repentance itself is a delightful exercise when it floweth from the principle of love. There is a secret sweetness which accompanieth those tears of remorse, those meltings and relentings of a soul returning unto God and lamenting its former unkindness. The severities of a holy life, and that constant watch which we are obliged to keep over our hearts and ways, are very troublesome to those who are only ruled and acted on by an external law, and have no law in their minds inclining them to the performance of their duty. But where divine love possesseth the soul, it stands as a sentinel to keep out everything that may offend the beloved, and doth disdainfully repulse those temptations which assault it. It complieth cheerfully, not only with explicit commands, but with the most secret notices of the beloved's pleasure, and is ingenious in discovering what will be most grateful and acceptable unto him. It makes mortification and self-denial change their harsh and dreadful names, and become easy, sweet, and delightful things. But I find this part of my letter swelling bigger than I had designed. Indeed, who would not be tempted to dwell on so pleasant a theme? I shall endeavor to compensate it by brevity in the other points. The excellency of charity. The next branch of the divine life is a universal charity and love. The excellency of this grace will be easily acknowledged, for what can be more noble and generous than a heart enlarged to embrace the whole world, whose wishes and designs are leveled at the good and welfare of the universe, which considereth every man's interests as his own. He who loveth his neighbor as himself can never entertain any base or injurious thought, or be wanting in expressions of bounty. He had rather suffer 1,000 wrongs than be guilty of one, and never accounts himself happy but when someone or another hath been benefited by him. The malice or ingratitude of men is not able to resist his love. He overlooks their injuries and pities their folly, and overcomes their evil with good, and never designs any other revenge against his most bitter and malicious enemies than to put all the obligations he can upon them, whether they will or not. Is it any wonder that such a person be reverenced and admired, and accounted the darling of mankind? This inward goodness and benignity of spirit reflects a certain sweetness and serenity upon the very countenance, and makes it amiable and lovely. It inspireth the soul with a noble resolution and courage, and makes it capable of enterprising and effecting the highest of things. Those heroic actions which we are wont to read with admiration have, for the most part, been the effects of the love of one's own country or of a particular friendship, and certainly a more extensive and universal affection must be much more powerful and efficacious. The pleasure that attends it. Again, as charity flows from a noble and excellent temper, so it is accompanied with the greatest satisfaction and pleasure. It delights the soul to feel itself thus enlarged, and to be delivered from those disquieting as well as deformed passions, malice, hatred, and envy, and become gentle, sweet, and benign. Had I my choice of all things that may tend to my present felicity, I would pitch upon this, to have my heart possessed with the greatest kindness and affection towards all men in the world. I am sure this would make me partake in all the happiness of others, their inward endowments and outward prosperity. Everything that did benefit and advantage them would afford me comfort and pleasure, and though I should frequently meet with occasions of grief and compassion, yet there is a sweetness in commiseration which makes it infinitely more desirable than a stupid insensibility. And the consideration of that infinite goodness and wisdom which governs the world might repress any excessive trouble for particular calamities that happen in it, and the hopes or possibilities of men's after happiness might moderate their sorrow for their present misfortunes. Certainly, next to the love and enjoyment of God, that ardent charity and affection wherewith blessed souls do embrace one another is justly to be reckoned as the greatest felicity of those regions above. And did it universally prevail in the world, it would anticipate that blessedness and make us taste of the joys of heaven upon earth. The excellency of purity. That which I named as a third branch of religion was purity. and you may remember I described it to consist of a contempt of sensual pleasures and a resoluteness to undergo those troubles and pains we may meet with in the performance of our duty. Now, the naming of this may suffice to recommend it as a most noble and excellent quality. There is no slavery so base as that whereby man becomes a drudge to his own lusts, or any victory so glorious as that which is attained over them. Never can that person be capable of anything that is noble and worthy who is sunk in the gross and fecund pleasures of sense, or bewitched with the light and airy gratifications of fancy. But the religious soul is of a more sublime and divine temper. It knows it was made for higher things, and scorns to step aside one foot out of the way of holiness for obtaining anything other than divine perfection. The delight it affords. And this purity is accompanied with a great deal of pleasure. Whatsoever defiles the soul disturbs it too. All impure delights have a sting in them, and leave smart and trouble behind them. Excess and intemperance and all inordinate lusts are so much enemies to the health of the body and the interests of this present life, that a little consideration might oblige any rational man to forbear them on that very score. And if the religious person go higher, and do not only abstain from noxious pleasures, but neglect those that are innocent, this is not to be looked upon as any violent or uneasy restraint, but as the effect of a better choice, that their minds are taken up in the pursuit of more sublime and refined delights, so that they cannot but be concerned in these. Any person that is engaged in a violent and passionate affection will easily forget his ordinary gratifications, will be little curious about his diet or his bodily ease, or to divertisement he was wanted to delight in. No wonder, then, if souls overpowered with divine love despise inferior pleasures, and be almost ready to grudge the body its necessary attendance for the common accommodations of life, judging all these impertinent to their main happiness, and those higher enjoyments that they are pursuing. As for those hardships they may meet with, they rejoice in them as opportunities to exercise and testify their affection, and since they are able to do so little for God, they are glad of the honor to suffer for Him. The excellency of humility. The last branch of religion is humility. And however to vulgar and carnal eyes this may appear an abject, base, and despicable quality, yet really the soul of man is not capable of a higher, more noble endowment. It is silly ignorance that begets pride, but humility arises from a near acquaintance with excellent things, which keeps men from doting on trifles, or admiring themselves because of some petty attainments. Noble and well-educated souls have no such high opinions of riches, beauty, strength, and other such like advantages, as to value themselves for them, or despise those that want them. And, as for inward worth and real goodness, the sense they have of the divine perfections makes them think very meanly of anything they have hitherto attained, and be still endeavoring to surmount themselves, and make nearer approaches to those infinite excellencies which they admire. I know not what thoughts people may have of humility, but I see almost every person pretending to it and shunning such expressions and actions as may make them be accounted arrogant and presumptuous, so that those who are most desirous of praise will be loath to commend themselves. What are all those compliments and modes of civility, so frequent in our ordinary converse, but so many protestations of the esteem of others, and the low thoughts we have of ourselves? And must not that humility be noble and excellent endowment, when the very shadows of it are accounted so necessary and part of good breeding? The pleasure and sweetness of a humble temper. Again, the grace is accompanied with a great deal of happiness and tranquility. The proud and arrogant person is a trouble to all that converse with him, but most of all unto himself. Everything is enough to vex him, but scarce anything sufficient to content and please him. He is ready to quarrel with everything that falls out, as if he himself were such a considerable person that God Almighty should do everything to gratify him, and all the creatures of heaven and earth should wait upon him and obey his will. The leaves of high trees do shake with every blast of wind, and every breath, every evil word will disquiet and torment an arrogant man. But the humble person hath the advantage, when he is despised, that none can think more meanly of him than he doth of himself, and therefore he is not troubled at the matter, but can easily bear those reproaches which wound the other to the soul. And withal, as he is less affected with injuries, so indeed he is less obnoxious unto them. Contention, which cometh of pride, betrays a man into 1,000 inconveniences which those of a more meek and lowly temper seldom meet with. True and genuine humility begetteth both a veneration and love among all wise and discerning persons, while pride defeateth its own design and depriveth a man of that honor it makes him pretend to. But, as the chief exercises of humility are those which relate unto Almighty God, so these are accompanied with the greatest satisfaction and sweetness. It is impossible to express the great pleasure and delight which religious persons feel in the lowest prostration of their souls before God, when, having a deep sense of the divine majesty and glory, they sink, if I may so speak, to the bottom of their beings and vanish and disappear in the presence of God, by a serious and affectionate acknowledgement of their own nothingness and the shortness and imperfection of their attainments. When they understand the full sense and emphasis of the psalmist's exclamation, "Lord, what is man?" and can utter it with the same affection. Never did any haughty or ambitious person receive the praises and applauses of men with so much pleasure as the humble and religious do renounce them. "Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto thy name give glory." Thus I have spoken something of the excellencies and advantages of religion in its several branches, but should be very injurious to the subject did I pretend to have given any perfect account of it. Let us acquaint ourselves with it, my dear friend. Let us acquaint ourselves with it, and experience will teach us more than all that ever hath been spoken or written concerning it. But if we may suppose the soul to be already awakened unto some longing desires after so great a blessedness, it will be good to give them vent and suffer them to issue forth in some aspirations as these. A prayer. Good God, what mighty felicity is this to which we are called! How graciously hast thou joined our duty and happiness together, and prescribed that for our work the performance whereof is a great reward! And shall such silly worms be advanced to such great a height? Wilt thou allow us to raise our eyes to thee? Wilt thou admit and accept our affection? Shall we receive the impression of thy divine excellencies by beholding and admiring them, and partake of thy infinite blessedness and glory by loving thee and rejoicing in them? Oh, the happiness of those souls that have broken the fetters of self-love and disentangled their affection from every narrow and particular good, whose understandings are enlightened by the Holy Spirit, and their wills enlarged to the extent of thine, who love thee above all things and all mankind for thy sake. I am persuaded, O God, I am persuaded that I can never be happy till my carnal and corrupt affections be mortified, and the pride and vanity of my spirit be subdued, and till I come seriously to despise the world and think nothing of myself. But, oh, when shall it once be? Oh, when wilt thou come unto me, and satisfy my soul with thy likeness, making me holy as thou art holy, even in all manner of conversation? Hast thou given me a prospect of so great a felicity, and wilt thou not bring me unto it? Hast thou excited these desires in my soul, and wilt thou not also satisfy them? Oh, teach me to do thy will, for thou art my God. Thy spirit is good. Lead me unto the land of uprightness. Quicken me, O Lord, for thy name's sakes, and perfect that which concerneth me. Thy mercy, O Lord, endureth forever. Forsake not the work of thine own hands. Part 3. The despondent thoughts of some newly awakened to a right sense of things. I have hitherto considered wherein true religion doth consist, and how desirable a thing it is. But when one sees how infinitely distant the common temper and frame of man is from it, he may perhaps be ready to despond, and give over, and think it is utterly impossible to be attained. He may sit down in sadness, and bemoan himself, and say in the anguish and bitterness of his spirit, "They are happy indeed whose souls are awakened unto the divine life, who are thus renewed in the spirit of their minds. But alas, I am quite of another constitution, and am not able to effect so mighty a change. If outward observance could have done the business, I might have hoped to acquit myself by diligence and care. But since nothing but a new nature can serve the term, what am I able to do? I could bestow all my goods in oblations to God, or alms to the poor, but cannot command that love and charity without which this expense, it would profit me nothing. This gift of God cannot be purchased with money. If a man should give all the substance of his house or for love, it would be utterly contemned. I could pine and macerate my body and undergo many hardships and troubles, but I cannot get all my corruption starved, nor my affections wholly weaned from earthly things. There is still some worldly desire lurking in my heart, and those vanities that I have shut out of the doors are always getting in by the windows. I am many times convinced of my own meanness, of the weakness of my body, and the far greater weakness of my soul. But this doth rather beget indignation and discontent than true humility in my spirit. And though I should come to think meanly of myself, yet I cannot endure that others should think so too. In a word, when I reflect on my highest and most specious attainments, I have reason to suspect that they are all but the effects of nature, the issues of self-love acting under several disguises, and this principle is so powerful and so deeply rooted in me, I can never hope to be delivered from the dominion of it. I may toss and turn as a door on the hinges, but can never get clear off, or be quite unhinged of self, which is still the center of all my motions. So that all the advantages I can draw from the discovery of religion is but to see, at a huge distance, that felicity which I am not able to reach, like a man in a shipwreck who discerns the land and envies the happiness of those who are there, but thinks it impossible for himself to get ashore." The unreasonableness of these fears. These, I say, or such like desponding thoughts, may arise in the minds of those persons who begin to conceive somewhat more of the nature and excellency of religion than before. They have spied the land, and seen that it is exceeding good, that it floweth with milk and honey, but they find they have the children of Anak to grapple with, many powerful lusts and corruptions to overcome, and they fear they shall never prevail against them. But why should we give way to such discouraging suggestions? Why should we entertain such unreasonable fears, which damp our spirits and weaken our hands and augment the difficulties of our way? Let us encourage ourselves, my dear friend, let us encourage ourselves with those mighty aids we are to expect in this spiritual warfare, for greater is he that is for us than all that can rise up against us. The eternal God is our refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. Let us be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might, for it is he that shall tread down our enemies. God hath a tender regard unto the souls of men, and is infinitely willing to promote their welfare. He hath condescended to our weakness, and declared with an oath that he hath no pleasure in our destruction. There is no such thing as a despite or envy lodged in the bosom of that ever-blessed being, whose name and nature is love. He created us at first in a happy condition, and now when we are fallen from it, he hath laid up help upon one that is mighty to save. He hath committed the care of our souls to no meaner person than the eternal Son of his love. It is he that is the captain of our salvation, and what enemies can be too strong for us when we are fighting under his banner? Did not the Son of God come down from the bosom of his Father and pitch his tabernacle among the sons of men, that he might recover and propagate the divine life and restore the image of God in their souls? All the mighty works which he performed, all the sad afflictions which he sustained, had this for their scope and design. For this did he labor and toil, for this did he bleed and die. He was with child, he was in pain, and hath he brought forth nothing but wind? Hath he wrought no deliverance on earth? Shall he not see the travail of his soul? Certainly it is impossible that his great contrivance of heaven should prove abortive, that such a mighty undertaking should fail and miscarry. it hath already been effectual for the salvation of many thousands who were once as far from the kingdom of heaven as we can suppose ourselves to be. And our high priest continueth forever, and is able to save them mightily and to the uttermost that come unto God by him. He is tender and compassionate. He knoweth our infirmities, and had experience of our temptations. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoking flax he will not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory. He hath sent out his Holy Spirit, whose sweet but powerful breathings are still moving up and down in the world, to quicken and revive the souls of men, and awaken them unto the sense and feeling of those divine things for which they were made, and is ready to assist such weak and languishing creatures as we are in our own essays toward holiness and felicity. And when once it hath taken hold of a soul, and kindled in it the smallest spark of divine love, it will be sure to preserve and cherish, and bring it forth unto a flame, which many waters shall not quench, neither shall the floods be able to drown it. Whenever this day begins to dawn, and the day star to arise in the heart, it will easily dispel the powers of darkness, and make ignorance and folly, and all the corrupt and selfish affections of men, flee away as fast as the shades of night, when the sun cometh out of his chamber. For the path of the just is as the shining light, which shineth more and more unto the perfect day. They shall go on from strength to strength, till every one of them appear before God in Zion. Why should we think it impossible that true goodness and universal love should ever come to sway and prevail in our souls? Is not this their primitive state and condition, their native and genuine constitution, as they came forth first from the hands of their Maker? Sin and corruption are but usurpers, and though they have long kept the possession, yet, from the beginning, it was not so. That inordinate self-love, which one would think were rooted in our very being and interwoven with the constitution of our nature, is nevertheless of foreign extraction and had no place at all in the original state of integrity. We have still so much reason left as to condemn it. Our understandings are easily convinced that we ought to be wholly devoted to Him from whom we have our being, and to love Him infinitely more than ourselves, who is infinitely better than we. And our wills would readily comply with this if they were not disordered and put out of tune. Is it not He who made our souls able to rectify and mend them again? And shall we not be able, by His assistance, to vanquish and expel those violent intruders, and turn unto flight the armies of the aliens? No sooner shall we take up arms in this holy war, but we shall have all the saints on earth, and all the angels in heaven, engaged on our party. The Holy Church throughout the world is daily interceding with God for the success of all such endeavors, and doubtless, those heavenly hosts above are nearly concerned in the interests of religion, and infinitely desirous to see the divine life thriving and prevailing in this inferior world, and that the will of God may be done by us on earth as it is done by themselves in heaven. And may we not then be encouraged ourselves, as the prophet did his servant when he showed him the horses and chariots of fire? Fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be against us. We must do what we can, and depend on the divine assistance. Away, then, with all perplexing fears and desponding thoughts. To undertake vigorously and rely confidently on the divine assistance is more than half the conquest. Let us arise and be doing, and the Lord will be with us. It is true, religion in the souls of men is the immediate work of God, and all our natural endeavors can neither produce it alone nor merit those supernatural aids by which it must be wrought. The Holy Ghost must come upon us, and the power of the Highest must overshadow us, before that holy thing can be begotten, and Christ be formed in us. But yet we must not expect that this whole work should be done without any concurring endeavors of our own. We must not lie loitering in the ditch, and wait till divine omnipotence pull us from thence. No, no! We must bestir ourselves and actuate those powers which we already have received. We must put forth ourselves to our utmost capacities, and then we may hope that our labor shall not be vain in the Lord. All the art and industry of man cannot form the smallest herb, or make a stalk of corn to grow in the field, It is the energy of nature and the influences of heaven which produce this effect. It is God who causeth the grass to grow and herb for the service of man. And yet nobody will say that the labors of the husbandman are useless or unnecessary. So, likewise, the human soul is immediately created by God. It is he who both formeth and enliveneth the child. And yet he hath appointed the marriage bed as the ordinary means for the propagation of mankind. Though there must intervene a stroke of omnipotence to effect this mighty change in our souls, yet we ought to do what we can to fit and prepare ourselves. For we must break up our fallow ground and root out the weeds and pull up the thorns, so that we may be more ready to receive the seeds of grace and the dew of heaven. It is true, God hath been found of some who sought him not. He hath cast himself in their way, who were quite out of his. He hath laid a hold upon them and stopped their course upon a sudden. For so was St. Paul converted in his journey to Damascus. But certainly this is not God's ordinary method of dealing with men. Though he hath not tied himself to means, yet he hath tied us to the use of them. And we have never more reason to expect the divine assistance than when we are doing our utmost endeavors. It shall therefore be my next work to show what course we ought to take for attaining that blessed temper I have hitherto described. But here, if in delivering my own thoughts, I shall chance to differ from what is, or may be said by others in this matter, I would not be thought to contradict and oppose them, more than physicians do, when they prescribe several remedies for the same disease, which perhaps all are useful and good. Every one may propose the method he judges most proper and convenient, but he doth not thereby pretend that the cure can never be effected unless that be exactly observed. I doubt it hath occasioned much unnecessary disquietude to some holy persons, that they have not found such a regular and orderly transaction in their souls as they have seen described in books, that they have not passed through all those steps and stages of conversion which some, who perhaps have felt themselves, have too peremptorily prescribed unto others. God hath several ways of dealing with the souls of men, and it sufficeth if the work be accomplished, whatever the methods have been. Again, though in proposing directions I must follow that order which the nature of things shall lead to, yet I do not mean that the same method should be so punctually observed in the practice, as if the latter rules were never to be heeded till some considerable time had been spent in practicing the former. The directions I intend are mutually conducive one to another, and all are to be performed as occasion shall serve, and we will find ourselves enabled to perform them.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's Edmonton, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship, in which they absurdly exercise themselves, would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.